You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. A special shout-out this week goes to our newest sponsor, the Frog Breeder Merch Store. Show off your love for frogs and conservation by picking up some unique amphibian merchandise with a portion of the proceeds going to Panamanian Amphibian Conservation and Research. With everything from adults to kids to stickers to t-shirts, the Frog Breeder Merch Store has everything for the frog lover out there. To find out more and to purchase some merch, check out the-frog-breeder-merch.myspreadshop.com and follow the link in the show description. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm your host, Dandra Bates, and I'm very excited this week because I've got two amazing guests. I have two researchers. I have Roberto Marquez and Rachel Arkin, and the two of them have done some really amazing work with poison frogs, and we're going to cover a lot of ground, so I'm really happy. I love doing these group interviews. It's a lot of fun. I hope you guys are looking forward to it. I know I have. And we're going to get into it just real quick. Big shout out to our sponsors this week, and of course, a big shout out to all the 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast player. A nice 5-star review goes a long way. Always appreciate that. And thank you to everybody on the patrons, everyone on the Patreon page. Remember, $5 a month tier. It's a $5 tier. Get your shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And if you're looking to support the show, by all means, check out the links in the show notes. That'll take you to all the fun stuff on the link tree. Many different ways to support the show. If that's what you want to do, by all means, check it out. So I want to get into it tonight because I've got a lot of ground to cover. I've got two great people here. So Roberto, Rachel, welcome. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing okay. Thanks for having us, Dan.
Yeah, thank you.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. So the two of you have some pretty amazing research done with poison frogs, and I want to get into it, but I was wondering if maybe each of you could kind of tell us about your background, tell us about who you are, what your first experiences were with the natural world or amphibians, et cetera, and what led you to where you are today.
Sure, I guess I can go first. So I'm a biologist, so my job is doing research on living things. I've been a frog nerd since I was a kid all the way. I grew up in Colombia, so there's no shortage of poison frogs there, and I've always been fascinated by them. So I decided to study biology in college and follow a research career, and I currently do research in poison dart frogs, especially coloration and toxicity.
And I guess I also loved animals from a young age, and where I actually found like my passion for things like animals and was I started going to summer camp at a place called Turtle Creek Farm in Michigan. And I started going when I was 5, and I actually still work there. But that actually put me on the path to try to get into vet school, which is what I'm still trying to do. But I graduated undergrad with a degree in ecology. So. And that's where we are at the moment.
It's an eclectic background. I number one, Colombia. I've had quite a few guests on from Colombia, and it is just such a biologically diverse and amazing country, and especially with regards to the poison frogs. Since the Phyllobates species, was there any particular species in Colombia that you saw when you were young that might have kind of cinched it and said, all right, I want to focus on this for the rest of my life?
Not Phyllobates, but I guess I should say all but two are actually endemic to Colombia. And, you know, Terribilis is famously toxic, so you would hear about this, right? Just like Americans hear about bald eagles and grizzly bears, we would hear about these crazy poison dart frogs when we were kids. The first poison dart or poison frog I ever saw was Dendrobates truncatus, and I thought it was really cool because it's a really cool looking frog. Then I saw Ophaga histrionica, which the hobbyists in the audience will definitely know about, and that's such a beautiful frog that absolutely got me interested. But the reason why I got into phylobates was because I needed a thesis to graduate. And a researcher at my university happened to be working on poison frogs. And he had a project that matched my interests in phylobates. And that six-month project got me roped. And I'm still here, I guess, 12 years later.
That's incredible. It's, you know, it's funny. I've had conversations with people, and it's interesting how a certain research project or something that's not necessarily like an active choice, it's something when people kind of get kind of just get involved in it just for whatever reason, and it becomes this lifelong path. That's amazing. And Rachel, how does this fit into veterinary medicine? Like, just out of curiosity, how does studying the poison frogs prepare you for veterinary school?
I guess for my degree at U of M, I needed research hours, which is how I got into this project. But I've always had an interest in frogs, and it was an opportunity that aligned things that I'm interested in, because I really want to go into exotics. So more than just cats and dogs, but still like pets people would have. And it was a very unique opportunity. So that's how I got into the frogs.
Well, you made a great choice. I feel like veterinary medicine is definitely progressing to include more. I mean, reptiles is one thing, but especially amphibians, there really seems to be a need for more vets that are comfortable working with amphibians.
That is the end goal one day.
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm going to ask each of you to reply to this question. It's kind of an open-ended, kind of like a loaded question, because I like to get everyone's thoughts on this. But with regards to amphibians, why study amphibians, and more specifically, why poison frogs?
Do you want to go, Rachel?
I mean, my answer will be a lot less specific and scientific, I feel like. But for me, they're just really cool, and I find them interesting. But also, I know that amphibians are just important in general for just like ecological reasons, but also because from the mindset of like animal care and vet care, like it's an animal that's in captivity that there's not much research on. So like the what needs to be done to care for them when they're in captivity might not the answer to like what a person should do. Nobody really has it. So there's nobody really knows the right way to do it yet.
And what about you, Roberto? What's your take on it?
Well, I'll absolutely second Rachel's answer. Frogs are really cool, and that's one of my main motivations for sure. But of course, you know, doing research, you also need to think about, you know, society that pays taxes that pay for a lot of research. So it's also good to think about like what the actual benefits are. From the vet medicine point of view, I absolutely agree with Rachel. We have exotics vets who will cover anything from a parrot to a dog. Yet we have vets that specialize on horses or cows or cats. And frogs are 300 million years old. Amphibians are 400 million years old. As a group, if we think about, you know, cats and dogs are maybe 50 million years apart. So doing research on amphibian specific problems is important from a husbandry point of view, because we don't know a lot, as Rachel was saying. From a more evolutionary biology point of view, which is my main field of expertise, amphibians just have a really diverse set of cool things, right? Dart frogs especially have evolved in very interesting ways. You might have heard poison frogs have evolved toxicity and coloration many, many times. You have things, you know, within dendrobatids, you have things like phyllobates have maybe evolved independently from the colorful Epipedobates, the colorful Amiregas, perhaps even the colorful Dendrobates. And then you have things like Mantella or Melanophryniscus, which are hundreds of millions of years away that yet have evolved similar toxins, similar colorations. And so as an evolutionary biologist, it's very interesting to ask, why do we see these independent evolutions of similar things happening? And how does it work, right? Does evolution do it the same way every time? Is it different ways? Can you make a poison frog in different ways? And so that's very interesting to me. Another thing is the alkaloids, right? If you think about it, caffeine is an alkaloid, cocaine is an alkaloid, morphine is an alkaloid. So humans interact with alkaloids specifically and toxins in general a lot. Yet we don't know too much about how vertebrates in general interact with these toxins. And so doing research on animals that live with them every day can help us understand how humans ourselves interact with these types of chemicals. And so I think these are all just good reasons to be curious about poison frogs and do research on them.
With regards to the alkaloids, for the listeners who might be a little bit more curious about like what an alkaloid actually is and how it affects a human body or a frog body, can you tell us a little bit about alkaloids, what they are and what effects they have on within biology?
Sure. So, I mean, first things first, I should say I'm not a chemist, so the chemists in the audience might have some complaints about things that I might get wrong. But alkaloids are just a family of chemicals that have specific chemical structures that are similar, and they're generally made by plants and some insects. The only vertebrate that can make alkaloids is the corroboree frog and perhaps other frogs in the genus Pseudophryne that are in Australia. And we don't really know why they're able to do this. But alkaloids generally are used by plants as defense compounds, right? They tend to taste bitter, and many of them have what we call neurotoxic effects, which means they interact with your nervous system in some way. The poison frog alkaloids tend to be neurotoxins that prevent neurons from firing. And so they will either reduce sensation, for example, in the skin. Some people who have been intoxicated by dart frogs report feeling tingling. That's because the nerves in your skin can't fire. Others will stop your muscles from moving. So, for example, the famous batrachotoxin in Phyllobates just stops muscles from working entirely. And that's why animals that ingest this toxin might end up dying. Other alkaloids, such as morphine, will interact with your nervous system to fool it into thinking it's not feeling pain, for example. Or caffeine will fool your nervous system into thinking you're not tired. And so, yeah, generally, the alkaloids that are neurotoxins just fool your nervous system into either not working or not perceiving your body's current state in some way.
And what do we know about how frogs derive those alkaloids from? I mean, generally, from what I understand, it's from a wild diet of some sort of unknown variable. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, what do we know about how those alkaloids move up the food chain and end up becoming, you know, part of a poison frog?
Yeah, that's a huge open question in dart frog biology. We definitely know they eat the alkaloids from their diet. Any of us or the people listening who have kept frogs have told somebody that their frogs are definitely not toxic because they're feeding them fruit flies or crickets or whatever. And we know they probably get them from insects or other small animals that they eat. We have been able, and as the scientists working on this, I have not done this personally, but we have been able to pin down some insects that have some of the alkaloids that we find later in frogs. But so what we think happens is they eat them and somehow move them from their stomachs or their intestines through the blood to the skin. And most of the time, the alkaloids are not even changed, apparently. In some cases, they are changed a little. But there have been some really sweet experiments where folks actually are able to make these alkaloids in the lab and then feed them to the frogs with a dropper. And they find the alkaloids in the skin a few hours or days later. So at least now the frogs are able to eat them and move them to the skin. The actual sources are not too clear for the majority of toxins, and what happens within the frogs is something we're just starting to scratch the surface on.
That's amazing. That's research I can't wait to find out about. It's been kind of the holy grail of dart frog research, is finding out what that key ingredient is that creates toxicity. Is that a universal thing for all poison frogs? Because I'm trying to think about the range of dendrobatids that extends from, let's just say, Central America down through South America, and by and large, a very, very large area. And I'm going to assume there's all different species of insects and whatnot. Is there some sort of convergence maybe insect convergence or plant convergence that allows multiple species in multiple different areas of Central and South America to sequester them similarly, or is it a different process?
That's a great question, and it's not been too well answered, I guess. It's a very tough question to answer, because if you think about it, the frogs are eating a bunch of insects over time and probably accumulating toxins for a while. And so the insects probably don't have a lot of toxins, which makes detecting the toxins pretty tough once you catch the insects, and catching tiny, tiny insects in the leaf litter in forests is difficult in itself already. There was a cool study by some colleagues at the City University of New York that looked at, from reports that people have done analyzing frog skins and then reports of just arthropod species. They found that arthropod diversity across Central America was somewhat associated with the toxin diversity that you see in frogs in different places, which kind of hints that perhaps the frogs are limited to what is there in terms of what they can sequester. But it's tough to know if we don't know which diet items to look for. That being said, the generality is that at least dendrobatids can't make their toxins, so they have to eat them. But you do have different species with very unique toxins, like batrachotoxin, for example. Wherever you find phyllobates, you will find dendrobates, you will find ophaga, you will find andinobates. You might even find some cholestetes that are toxic. Yet only phyllobates, we think, are able to accumulate batrachotoxin. So I guess my answer is going to be it's complex, but the environment is certainly important, right? Whatever is there is what the frogs are going to have a chance to accumulate in their skin.
Yeah, it just amazes me how I love convergent evolution, and I find it interesting when something that's, in a different part of the world evolves the same methods of living, and it's incredible. I want to get into that a little bit further in a little bit, but Rachel, I want to talk about some of your research with carotenoids. So carotenoids have always been kind of an interesting topic with wild poison frogs, with captive and captive frogs that are being released. I've talked to people about working with some of the ophaga species and the value of carotenoids with regards to their coloration in the wild versus captivity. But, the role and importance of carotenoids for normal development and reproduction, that's also a topic that comes up. I was wondering if you could tell us about the paper you have in review and maybe, kind of discuss like what your findings were. I think it was the effects of preformed vitamin A and provitamin vitamin A carotenoid sublimation on tadpoles in Phyllobates vitatus, right? Tell us about the paper. Tell us why you decided to take on this specific topic of carotenoids, and kind of walk us through what you found.
I guess what actually started my interest is I was helping feed the frogs in the lab, and I was looking at just like the different supplements that were used, and I was kind of like, or even like at a pet store, and it was like, why do we use them, or like how much are we supposed to use? And there weren't really answers to these questions, which is what led me to do the project of where we supplemented vitamin A and and beta carotene for the tadpole diet.
So vitamin A is in different forms. I was wondering if you could maybe explain the difference between preformed vitamin A and provitamin A, and you know what's the difference between the two.
So for our project, we used a provitamin A. We have a provitamin A carotenoid, like beta carotene, like what's in carrots. And that is, at least we know in a lot of animals, not for sure in amphibians, but I mean, humans can convert beta carotene into vitamin A. So I guess that's provitamin A. I think that's what you might be asking about from the paper. And so a lot of times we don't know if feeding the beta carotene to an amphibian, if they're able to convert it to the vitamin A, which is a necessary nutrient for survival.
Well, what were some of the protocols? Maybe kind of walk us through the steps of like what happened during this whole process.
So I guess we had four different groups of tadpoles, and we had one that was fed just like a fish flake diet that we saw was used in other experiments, that was the nutrient content was analyzed. And then in another group, we just gave beta carotene, the provitamin A carotenoid. And the third group, we gave just vitamin A, and the fourth, we gave both. Supplements, and then we watched them go through metamorphosis, and we looked at how quickly they went through metamorphosis, their survival, and then like their size after metamorphosis. And we found that when they were supplemented with both vitamin A and beta carotene, or just vitamin A alone, there was actually negative effects, which was kind of unexpected, considering that there's all these supplements that they sell for frogs, like at the pet store, and they're encouraged to do. So it was unexpected to see that it was either like neutral or negative effects on their growth and development.
And this was all tadpoles, right? Was there any supplementation to the parents or just the tadpoles?
Just the tadpoles.
Okay, interesting, interesting. Yeah, I had read a paper... Oh, it's a while back. I think I can actually pull it up here. Yeah, it was going back a ways. It was actually, I think, with human medicine, but the author of the paper kind of played around with carotenoids in frogs a little bit. I'm trying to, yeah, here it is. Yeah, this is from 2014. Yeah, Vitamin A, Metabolism and Actions. This was by, Robin D. Clugston. Yeah, that was the last article I could find about the subject. And it's one of those things where, this type of research is so beneficial because I feel like people have a lot of questions about the value of vitamin supplements, specifically vitamin A. And the more research we have, the more it just definitely helps present the whole picture of what's needed, especially with regards to husbandry, because I've had conversations with people that have run the gambit. I've had some people use a lot. I've had some people use a little. But this is interesting. So if you were to speculate, what do you think this would mean long term for captive management? If you would speculate, what kind of a protocol do you think might come of this in the future?
Well, I think the biggest conclusion that we came to with this project was actually that there just needs to be so much more research done, because what seemed to work for one species of frog doesn't seem to work for the other, because of what we brought up earlier about how many million years ago they shared a common ancestor. They're all so different that just because research is done on one species doesn't necessarily mean that what is found can just be applied to another species, copy and pasted. They're all very different. So I think that was the biggest finding here. it wasn't even like what should be done or what shouldn't. It's like, it's more like we need to look at each species of frog differently.
Great point. That's one of those things that I've been arguing for a long time is, you know, when we think of mammals, especially with regards to, you know, let's just say companion animals, cats and dogs, I mean, that's two species. Whereas with frogs, I mean, there's, from what's available in captivity, I'm assuming there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, can then compare that to everything in the wild. But no, that definitely raises a good point about addressing each species individually. I mean, are there any other species that you'd be interested in working with besides Vitatus to see how they would fare?
For me, I honestly don't have an answer to that question because the species I worked with is what was available. What we had tadpoles or eggs at the right timing, and I don't know enough to have a good answer to that. But there probably are many more that need to be looked at.
I got you. Okay. Yeah. Well, it's definitely, there's so many species out there. There's going to be plenty to work with. You know, Roberto, we talked a little bit earlier about batrachotoxin, and I have a follow-up question for you. And it's really, I mean, batrachotoxin is one of the most well-known, one of the most notorious toxins on Earth. And we're aware of its lethality to other organisms. But the another major question that I think all of us have had, maybe secondary to, you know, where does this toxicity come from? What's the food source? Is how do the frogs not poison themselves? Like how do batrachotoxin bearing frogs avoid self-intoxication?
Yeah, well, that's something I've been interested in for a while. I actually did my master's on that. And the short answer is we thought we knew and now we don't. So initially, you know, this specifically batrachotoxin attacks these proteins and neurons called sodium channels, which are one of the main players in creating currents through neurons, right? In maintaining the right conditions for electricity to flow through neurons. And batrachotoxin just screws up the way in which they work so that your neurons can't fire and your muscles can't contract. So for a while, I was studying the genes that make these proteins and trying to see if maybe the frogs had evolved slightly different genes that are not susceptible to the toxin but still do their job. And it seemed like it from just looking at the sequences coding for these genes and the proteins that they encode. But they are these big clunky proteins that are hard to study biochemically. So we kind of left it at these frogs have mutations in parts of the protein that neuroscientists in the past have shown interact with the toxin, and that are places that are very important for protein function. So evolution shouldn't change them too much because that would usually be bad, unless those changes specifically do something good, like allowing you to resist the toxin that you're using to defend yourself from predators. But then more recently, some colleagues were actually able to make the frog protein and test it in the lab, and it seems like it interacts with batrachotoxin not too differently from a human protein and is susceptible to batrachotoxin. And then other colleagues were able to show that other frog alkaloids, but this might be the case for batrachotoxin, are actually transported in the blood by other proteins that hold on to the alkaloids really well. So right now, I guess our working hypothesis is that maybe when the frogs eat the toxins, there is a protein that hangs on to the toxins very well and doesn't let them do damage. But still, in the case that the toxin does kind of get loose, you want your target proteins that the toxin would affect to not be as susceptible, right? So it seems to be like a whole organism kind of response rather than a single magical gene. But in the end, we really don't know, and this is something that I really want to work on going forward. But it is a fascinating question, right? It's supposed to be one of the most lethal toxins known, yet these frogs just walk around carrying enough toxin to kill a few humans, and nothing happens to them.
Yeah, it's one of those miracles of nature. There's also Batrachotoxin bearing birds, right? It's not just frogs. There's also species of birds.
Yeah, that is one of those just cool things that exists. So there's a few different species of birds in Southeast Asia, I think especially New Guinea, that have batrachotoxin in their skin. And in that case, we do know they eat these beetles that are big and orange, so maybe also accumulating toxins for defense. And so we think they get the batrachotoxin from there. Those birds, their sodium channel genes don't even look like they would resist batrachotoxin, so those are even a bigger mystery. And we have no idea why those birds resist the toxin. But it's really crazy that some frogs in South America have the exact same toxin as some birds in New Guinea, and they both eat it from the environment. So it just, you know, speaks to maybe nature having some specific general rules that make particular scenarios easier than others. But, you know, as you've said, these are just big open questions that have been around for ages.
Yeah, it's just always fascinated me. The toxicity is, like, if you get past the, you know, that everyone's kind of always obsessed with the shock value of the severity of the toxicity. And to me, I was always more interested in how, you know what I mean? Like, how is this possible? How can something be so toxic and then, you know, continue to live its life like it was nothing at all? Do we know if toxicity varies, like, at different points of the frog's life or at different life cycles? Is there seasonal functionality, or are they always kind of consistently toxic throughout the year, throughout their lives?
Right. That's a great question, especially considering they're eating the toxins, right? In terms of the life cycle, there's been some really cool research, especially on egg-feeding frogs like Ophaga or Mantella, where it has been shown that the moms actually pass toxins through the eggs to their tadpoles. And so in those species, we think they're able to have toxins from early on. On the other hand, there's been some really cool research on how the poison glands develop, showing that recently metamorphosed frogs don't have well-developed poison glands, which has led some people to think maybe they're not able to sequester as much toxin. And at least in my experience breeding captive breeding frogs, the juveniles are definitely a lot more skittish than the adults. So there might be something there about changing behavior once you're toxic. But this is also pretty unexplored terrain, right? It would be very cool to do experiments like feeding juvenile frogs toxins and seeing if they're able to accumulate as much as adults. On the seasonal variation side of things, that hasn't been explicitly looked at that I know, but I can think of a couple of very cool studies looking at frogs of the same species in different habitats. For example, old growth forest versus recently intervened forest, which should have different insect communities. And it does seem to have an effect on the alkaloids you find in the frog's skins. So, you know, if the food supply that is relevant to toxicity varies over time or over space, it's easy to see how that would definitely affect the toxins that the frogs are carrying themselves.
Interesting. You know, I forgot to ask, how many species of frogs are you working with at your lab now? Is it just Vitatus, or are like the two of you working with other species of Phyllobates?
So in the lab, we keep live colonies of four species, Aurotania, Turribilis, Bicolor, and Vitatus. It seems like Aurotania has multiple species, and we're not too sure how many of those make up what our colony. But in general, my research is very focused on all Phyllobates, but also on poison frogs in general, and even just frogs as a group, right? So I guess, you know, live frog work that we're doing in the lab is mainly focused on four species, but we study frogs across the board whenever we can.
I see. And another question I have for you is, the Phyllobates genus, there's several different locales or color morphs, or however we want to phrase it. And you've done some work with genetics. I was wondering if you could tell us about genetic variants and phenotype variation with regards to Phyllobates. Why are there so many color variants within the genus, and really on a species level too? How did this occur, and what does it mean in the grand scheme of things?
Right, so that's a huge question, right? That's one of like the most interesting questions to me. In general, Phyllobates are a little less diverse than, say, Pumilio or Ranitomaya, who have like these within species crazy levels of variation. What we find is more between localities or between groups. And what interests me a lot is that if you look at other systems, you have a big diversification into many morphs. In Phyllobates, what we find the most is the repeated evolution of similar morphs. So if you remember, Phyllobates are either dark and striped, like Vitatus, Aurotania, Lugubris. And then you have Bicolor and Turribilis, which are solid yellow. And we've actually got some evidence that Bicolor might be two different species. And so from our research looking at just the evolutionary history of these morphs, it seems like the yellow morph has evolved a bunch of different times. It seems like three in a very short time frame. And so the question is why, which I don't have a great answer for. Personally, my opinion is it's probably adaptation to something which, following the general poison frog story, is probably predation, right? They're trying to avoid predators in some way. And the why they end up in these very similar color morphs is very interesting. It could be either because it's a very, very good form of warning coloration, or it could be because it's very easy to evolve that, being a Phyllobates, right? There might be something in the genetics that control coloration that makes a small change turn you yellow. But which of those two, or how important each of those two explanations is a very active line of research right now in my lab, I guess.
You know, something just piqued my interest about what you just mentioned about bicolor being two species. So, I mean, right now in the hobby, there's the Uraba locale of Phyllobates bicolor. And I have another locale. I have a locale that's called Greenleg. And one of the things that I've talked about repeatedly on this show over the past 4 years now is the difference between the Uraba locale and my Greenlegs, which look like little, you know, my Uraba are much leaner frogs, bigger jumpers. My green leg locale is much more plump. They look more like a Turribilis. What's happening now with regards to bicolor that it might be two species? I mean, is it possible that I might have two different species that are both under the name of bicolor?
Yeah, so I actually have both of those strains too. And I've been reading up on the history, you know, digging up old dendroboard posts and such. So in nature, we have, you know, gone to a bunch of places where these frogs exist and collected genetic samples, collected specimens, measured the frogs, looked at their calls, stuff like that. And it does seem like basically south of a particular mountain range, you find one group that is genetically concordant and has similar calls, is bigger. It actually doesn't have green legs. And north of that, you find another group that does have green legs, which is where both the Tesoros strain comes from, the one that's called Udawa. And, you know, so those have green legs. The other one doesn't have green legs. And I think that's like a coloration difference. That being said, looking at, so, you know, those two groups in nature seem to be pretty distinct, and they seem to have just evolved to be yellow frogs in high elevations, which is why before our work, the community thought they were the same species. In captivity in the U.S., before the Tesoros imports, there were some imports in the 90s, which I think came from both species. And so what we might have in the pet trade right now is some sort of mix of the two, which is what people call the green legs, or like the old Josh's frog strain, I've heard it called as well. It's just whatever bicolor you could find, you know, in the from the mid 2010s to earlier, like to the 90s. I have sequenced my strains here. I have sequenced their DNA. And I haven't dug into it too deeply, but they do look a little mixed. But that is tough to tell in captive strains because everyone is cousins with everybody. And so that complicates the genetic analysis a little bit. But in the end, even if those were the same species, they've been in captivity for different amounts of time. And, you know, frogs do adapt to captivity, right? Over time, whatever ends up making up a line is the individuals that were able to thrive and reproduce in captivity. So keeping frogs in captivity is going to make them evolve a little bit as well. So, you know, the bicolor deal, I think what you're saying is right. There are two species in the field, and what we see here is a reflection of that. I'm not sure right now that it actually maps to the two pure species being in the pet trade. I think there might have been some mixture because we were calling them the same name.
My mind is blown because all this time I started thinking, I'm like, why are these two so different? Because I got the import from Tesoros when those first came in, and I remember, I'm like, why? This does not look like the bicolors I have. And, you know, much to my chagrin, the green leg locale that I had, they just consistently lay infertile clutches. I was never able to get a fertile clutch or even a significant amount of breeding from that pair. So,
yeah, actually, just a fun anecdote. We actually found, out of luck, one of my green legs was actually a tetraploid, like Xenopus, where they have two separate copies of the genome. And so it was infertile because of that. So, you know, I think that green leg strain is really inbred and might even be a mix of two different species, which is why bicolor are thought to be so hard to breed. Because the Tesoros ones are pretty easy, actually. They're just like other phyllovates. They lay a bunch of eggs. They're super happy to call all the time.
Okay, my mind is blown even more now. That's incredible. I mean, I'm sure it happened. You hear it all the time, but I've only heard about that happening with species of salamander in the central U.S. So then basically what you're saying is there's a significant possibility that they're just kind of like, I mean, for lack of a better term, like sterile hybrids.
Yeah, I don't know if the sterility would be out of hybridization. the you know, if in fact, if indeed two species got mixed, that probably happened a long time ago, and so whatever survives now are basically descendants of the hybrids that weren't sterile. But that doesn't mean they're not going to have problems, right? And it could be because of the hybridization, it could be because of inbreeding. We just don't know, and it would be really fun to look into it.
How long have you had your green legs?
9 years, because I got them when my daughter was very young.
That's about how long I've had mine for, yeah. That's that's interesting, because I haven't seen them in the trade since maybe 2017 or so. They just sort of disappeared.
They did. Yeah, I got mine from Josh's Frogs, and they don't have that line anymore. There's a couple people that still have them, but you're right, they're way harder to find these days.
I know of, I think Patrick Neighbors might actually have them. Because I was looking, once I had a hard time finding them, I thought to myself, all right, this is odd. And, I didn't place much stock in the name Greenleg, because I figured it was just, you know, might've just been a marketing thing, because there wasn't a name for them. But, and then the Tesoros import came in, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is like two completely different frogs here. I'm not even going to put these together, because obviously they do look very, very different. And in my, you know, kind of just online browsing to try and find, maybe adding another male, maybe something was going on, maybe make a small group of them. And I think I ran across Patrick Neighbors having some, but that was the last time I looked. I've kind of given up on it since. But wow, that answers a lot of questions I've had for a very, very long time. That's incredible. And here's another question for you. I mean, the juvenile Phyllobates all kind of look similar. And I've noticed that, like bicolor, for example, will turn yellow, whereas some of the other species kind of retain that sort of juvenile coloring, like Vitatis, I think, kind of retains that throughout life. Do you have any thoughts or insight on why that happens?
I'll tell you in like 5 years, because that's what I'm actively doing research on right now.
Oh, awesome.
Right, so that's, from an evolutionary perspective, that's the coolest thing about Phyllobates, right? We can see how the differences between species arise, because when they do metamorphosis, they all start very similar, right? They're all black with a stripe. And then we see Terribilis and Bicolor lose their stripe and become fully yellow. So with another student in the group, and Rachel actually helped us raise a lot of those frogs when she was in the lab, we've been looking at how the pigment cells change over time. And so it seems like, and we still need to work more on this, but for now it seems like the cells that contain melanin move from the top to the skin to the bottom, and then new cells that are yellow are born and kind of populate the top of the skin, which is what we see. So, you know, from a very mechanistic point of view, it seems like just how the different pigments in the skin are organized is what changes over time. Why this happens is an interesting question, because it's very atypical for frogs to change color after metamorphosis. So, you know, there are ideas like maybe the juveniles are not toxic, so it's better for them to be a darker color, perhaps more camouflaged. But it could also be that given the genetics of coloration in this group, that's how you make a yellow frog, right? There's just something that makes them prone to evolving into becoming yellow after metamorphosis. But we don't really know, honestly, how that's happening right now. That's something I'm trying to figure out very emphatically right now.
Yeah, it's a question I've always had. You know, another question. So, I mean, by and large, Phyllobates is the most medically significant toxic genus of frogs. How do we quantify toxicity among species within the genus? Meaning, how do we compare, say, Vitatus and Bicolor or any, how do we quantify how toxic one is in comparison to the other and then compare to other Dendrobatids? Is there a way to do that?
That is a great question. And it depends on how you define toxicity, right? So toxicity to humans has traditionally been measured by extracting toxins in some way, which most of the time meant sacrificing the frog and grinding up the skin and purifying the toxins out, and then injecting toxins into, for example, a mouse and seeing and looking at the effects. And that can be in, you know, how it reacts behaviorally, how long it takes to die if you're dealing with very toxic molecules, and then kind of extrapolating, okay, a mouse is this heavy, how would this affect a human that is these many times heavier? And that is, from a medical perspective, which is focused on humans, a decent way to look at toxicity. If we want to understand these frogs in their own ecological context, then we have to ask, toxic to whom, right? And so we could, you know, we would need to know who the predators are, which is difficult in some cases. But you could, for example, try to quantify how much toxin a frog has and then try to model how it would affect the nervous system of a snake or a bird. And the cool thing there is that predators can also evolve to resist toxins, right? There's a very cool story about newts in the west coast of the U.S. that have a lot of tetrodotoxin, and these snakes that have evolved to resist them. And they're in this sort of arms race where the newt becomes more toxic and the snake becomes more resistant and the newt becomes more toxic. So even if the newt seems incredibly toxic to humans, it maybe isn't that toxic to snakes that have evolved to eat it. And maybe in frogs like Terribilis, that might be why they are so toxic, right? Maybe there is some predator that we don't know that has evolved to resist them, and they're engaged in this evolutionary race that we just haven't discovered yet.
That's amazing. So another thing I'd gone through in your research, and I'm gonna provide links to, you know, all of your work at the end of the episode, so anybody who's interested can find out. But this is kind of an interesting term, leapfrogging. So what is leapfrogging with regards to gene flow between neighboring populations of the same species? I love the name, and I had to ask you more about it just based on the name alone.
Yeah, that's a cool term in biogeography, right? So in the side of biology that deals with why certain organisms are where they are and how they kind of got there. It was a term actually coined in birds, but it refers to cases where you have, within a species or maybe a group of closely related species, you have very similar looking species in different places, right? So the leapfrogging is like you have, in dart frogs, for example, you have one color pattern in one place and then you switch into another and then you get again to the original color pattern or to the first one that I happened to mention. And in Phyllobates, we see that with Bicolor and Terribilis, right? You find Bicolor in the foothills of the Western Andes in Western Colombia. And then if you kind of trace your finger down the range of Phyllobates, you would encounter a bunch of Oratania populations. And then you would get to Terribilis in the southwest at the coast. And so why that range of those two morphs is separate at the time we wrote that paper was an interesting question, because we weren't even sure if Bicolor and Terribilis were closely related or not. And so in Phyllobates, it seems like you just get those different morphs in different places because perhaps those are the places where those morphs are adaptive or good for those species. We tried to look into other explanations, like maybe them being closely related or there having been some hybridization between the species that allowed the coloration genes to jump from one place to the other. And we really didn't find any evidence of those. So it looks like perhaps they have just independently evolved similar colorations in different places.
Is there ever a gradient where the range of two morphs within the same species come close to each other? Is there any kind of, a frog, say you have, a yellow frog on one side and an orange frog on one side, do you have a yellow orange frog in the middle, or are they completely distinct?
Most of the time they just pretty much hard to replace one another. They change, but there is one part in an elevation gradient in the Chocó department in Colombia where you have a very smooth transition between bicolor and Oratania. And so you find a lot of things that look intermediate in between, which is where a morph of Oratania that pretty much disappeared from the pet trade, but that was around in the 90s and 2000s, called the broadband morph, comes from. And so I did most of my PhD trying to understand that system. And it does seem that that variation happens because there are a lot of hybrids between bicolor and Oratania. What we think happened is that a population that looked like Oratania invaded the mountains, so they just expanded the range up into the mountains maybe 500,000 years ago, or maybe a little less. And they just evolved into being yellow up in the mountains, and we don't know why. It might have been because they encountered different predators. Perhaps the light environment is different because they went from a lowland rainforest to a highland cloud forest. Or, you can dream up any explanation. We don't really have a good idea of what went on. But since this happened so recently, the two species are still able to hybridize. And so we find these intermediate individuals in the middle because of that. But that is, up till now, the one kind of transition zone we see between striped and yellow species.
Interesting. What about with regard to Terebilis, the mint and the orange blackfoot locales? Do you have any insight on those morphs, or because to my knowledge, those are I think there's those two, and then there's the yellow. I think there's an orange morph as well, but are there any other morphs out there, or what's your take on all the morphs within Terebilis?
That's a really interesting system because they're all very close to one another. The yellow versus orange morph, it's not that clear in nature. You definitely see the variation, but it's much more continuous. So it might be a thing that happened in captivity just because people kept the more similar things together. But we haven't. That's just an appreciation I have. I don't have data to back this up. We do know, and this is very much ongoing work, so I'm going to be very cautious. We have some very preliminary evidence that the yellow and mint morphs are very close to one another genetically, to the point where they might not even form distinct groups, which tells us this is probably a very recent thing. We don't find hybrids in the field from what I know, but I'm definitely not one of the people who has sampled these morphs the most. But as far as I know, we don't find intermediates between them, which could just mean that one of the two morphs is dominant over the other. So if one of your parents is of either morph, you are automatically born being that morph. But they're very close genetically, so it is, it's very interesting in that way. It seems to be a very recent or ongoing kind of thing. So towards the future, we are very interested in finding out what the genetic basis of the two morphs is to understand more how, where they come from.
That's wild. And I know that one of the the poison frog hobby has certain tenets that, you know, people generally seem to adhere to. And one of those tenets is not to hybridize. And the more we have this discussion, the more we kind of, you know, go down this path, it really does seem like a means to justify not hybridizing. So, I mean, is there, again, I don't want to speculate because I know you said it's the scientific research isn't quite there yet, but is it possible that the mint morph is like somewhat of a recessive gene, and then that's kind of been, well, kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like selectively bred for in captivity?
So the first part of your question, whether it's a recessive trait, it could be that the mint morph is recessive, or it could be that the mint morph is dominant. We actually, funnily, we just haven't done the crosses, because that would be very easy to figure out in the lab if you manage to cross the two morphs. You know, whether folks want to hybridize them in captivity or not depends on what you want to do. You know, by hybridizing them, you might risk hybridizing things that are a little distinct evolutionarily, so you might have problems with the offspring. And if you hybridize things that are geographically distinct and that don't exchange genes naturally, you won't get a faithful representation of what is out there. In my own opinion, it depends on what you want to do. So if you want to keep them as distinct as possible, then by no means, then don't hybridize them. But I don't think it's necessarily bad. As for whether the mint morph has been selected for in captivity, it could be, but you do find populations that are entirely mint in the wild. So that morph, to me at least, is undoubtedly a natural morph that exists in nature and that has evolved in some particular context that we don't know very well yet. But it doesn't seem to be an artificial thing from the lab.
Wow.
Or from the pet trade.
It gets you thinking. I mean, while we're talking about captivity and the hobbyist input on this, I know you mentioned Dendriboard earlier as being a source, and I've had a few people on kind of mention the same thing, that they kind of skim, you know, not skim, but they very, very meticulously went through all these different posts in Dendriboard, going back as far as they could to kind of find some of the histories. I remember I had one guest on, we talked about the Azurius morph of Tinctorius, and that was a source for him to kind of figure out what he wanted to know. What impact has the captive poison frog hobby had on research? Like, when you compare that to, say, in situ studies with wild frogs, what significance has the hobby had in your type of work and your type of research?
Well, so I guess, you know, as biologists, we try to understand life like in its entirety, right? So studies in nature are great because you study life in its context, I guess, in its like full splendor. But there are things that are very tough to do in nature. You can't do crosses of different morphs. You can't observe how tadpoles grow over time. You can't do a lot of things in nature. So lab studies arose, you know, thousands of years ago as ways to do science in ways that you can control more of the things that are happening so that you can isolate the phenomenon that you're interested in. In poison frogs, there is a very long history of studies in the field that were kind of parallel and interacting a little bit with the hobby. Now that there is a big push in biology to try to connect these natural history, ecology, evolution studies in the field with things in the lab that we can do to study more of the mechanisms within the organism that drive evolution, the hobby actually made our job very easy because we can find the species that we study in the field in the pet trade, so we don't need to extract individuals from the field when we don't absolutely need to. The hobbyists have figured out how to keep these frogs in captivity, which is no small feat. And, you know, there's just this huge trove of knowledge in the hobby that a scientist can draw from. And, you know, maybe we need to systematize a little more and research more in more, I guess, scientific ways. But it is there. Just going back to Rachel's paper, the realization that you need to supplement the frog's diet came from the hobby. And that's a big jump. Now we're figuring out the details of how to do it. But the hobby in general has had a very positive impact in science. Of course, there is always going to be unscrupulous people that are going to want to get wild frogs for whatever reason. And that has a negative impact on natural populations, not necessarily directly on the science. But in general, I think, you know, in addition to figuring out how you keep these frogs in captivity, the hobby also has the positive effect of making folks interested in dart frogs, right? So, yeah, in general, I think the hobby has had a very positive impact on poison frogs, or on poison frog research, I mean.
I feel like they're so charismatic that they have this appeal that people just love being around them, looking at them, love seeing them, love, you know, building these beautiful vivariums for them. So it's kind of like I feel bad for like the little tiny like brown frogs that no one really, you know, pays much attention to, because some of those are the ones that need the most care. Whereas like the vibrantly colored yellow, you know, red, visually stunning ones seem to get the lion's share of attention. So I guess they have that. That's going to them. That's going to be their benefit, I suppose.
Yeah.
So what does the future hold for the two of you? Like, with regards to research or careers, I know Rachel, why don't we start with you, Rachel? I know your aspirations are to become a vet. I mean, in a perfect world, if you could open up a practice, like, would you want to focus on exotics? And if so, like, where would you want your research to go to kind of point you in that direction?
Well, I mean, when most people ask me, I say I'm comfortable with all animals smaller than me. So anything from cats, dogs, snakes, birds, frogs. So that is what I am very interested in and hope to do one day. But as of right now, I'm in a point where we'll see.
It is a market for it, though. You know, I've had a conversation with a few vets. I mean, when you compare it to large animal vets or small animal practice, I mean, from what I understand, small animal practice is like kind of like taken off, and large animal practice is kind of not the presence that it used to be. But I mean, I can tell you there's so many people out there with frogs that are looking for quality trained vets to be able to, you know, to be their vet and to give them medical care. You know, there's a lot of people that want, you know, they want fecals done on their animals. They want wellness checks. They want, you know, animals treated for parasites and injuries and things like that. And just, you know, there is definitely a need for more vets trained in amphibian and other exotic medicine.
Yeah, I mean, from what I have learned about the process, I know there's like almost like a residency type thing that would come along with vet school to be able to get to that point, to be able to provide care for those animals. But that is the goal. But yeah, I very much agree with everything you said.
Well, I mean, I wish you the best of luck. Honestly, I'd love to hear from you once you get in there, because I'm always curious about like the curriculum, like what's being taught. Because I mean, I have a copy of Mater's Reptile and Amphibian Husbandry Medicine, and there's like the amphibian chapter is like they're just like little appendices on the end of like each chapter. So the quantity of research is increasing, which is good. And that's not to disparage Mater's. Mater's is a great book, but there's so much more needs to be found out about how to, you know, properly care for these things.
Yeah, I very much agree. That's how I came up with this question in the first place.
Yeah. And Roberto, I mean, I know you have so many irons in the fire here. There's so many projects that you're working on. I mean, what do you expect to, like, what's your goal for 5 years? Let's just say your research goals. What projects are you working on, and what questions do you expect to answer, or hopefully come close to answering, within the next 5 years?
That's a great question. So, you know, right now, I think I have two main projects, and they're both related. The first one is trying to understand how coloration and toxicity evolve together, right? The whole idea that coloration is a warning for toxicity means that these two pretty complex traits need to move in the same direction, right? You're either colorful and toxic, or camouflaged and probably non-toxic, because why would you be eating a bunch of toxic things if you're not using them to avoid predators? But being colorful and non-toxic would probably suck, because you would get seen a lot but eaten a lot. And so, you know, you can come up with an explanation that, okay, because it's good to be colorful and toxic, then maybe natural selection does this. But if you think about how strong of a selective force you would need to actually get this to happen, it's pretty, pretty strong. So I'm thinking about whether there might be some sort of commonality at the genetic level between the two that allows the very rapid evolution of these two traits that we see in dart frogs and in phyllobates especially. And I have no idea if that is the case, but so I'm trying to find out whether that is the case. And the other side of things is just making dart frogs a proper lab and field system, right? The ultimate biological system to study big, big questions in evolution. So we've studied a lot of stuff in the fields, but we have some big gaps, like not knowing what the predators are in the natural history side of the frogs. And we've started bringing them into the lab, but we have some big gaps, starting with what do you feed them, which is what Rachel very awesomely started helping me understand. But we're also trying to advance other things that people often do with fruit flies or with mice in the lab, trying to adapt them to poison frogs. So we're starting to think about genome editing in poison frogs. We're starting to think about using poison frogs, for example, to study brain function in similar ways as we do with other lab animals, so that we can address these questions on why poison frogs are the cool animals that they are from very detailed, very kind of rigorous biological perspectives. So that's where I'm trying to go now.
That's great. I mean, I want to thank the two of you both so much for your contributions. I mean, this has been an amazing conversation. I've learned so much. I mean, just thank you to the both of you for really, like, taking an interest in these things, because I love nerding out on this stuff like this, and it's just been such a pleasure talking to the two of you.
Thank you for having us.
That's my pleasure. Yeah. So I was wondering if each of you could just mention any, I'm going to provide some links, but if anybody's interested in learning more about, you know, your research or any of the papers, you know, social media, anything like that, if you guys have anything you want to share with the listeners, by all means, you know, go ahead.
Well, I'm on Twitter, I guess. You can find me at RMP033, and the story of that name is irrelevant, but I'll send it to Dan if that's an option. And I'm moving to Virginia, actually, so if there are any listeners in Appalachia, I would love to hear from you. I'm moving to Virginia Tech to start a proper lab there. So that's, yeah, I guess that's what I'm going to say to that.
And you have a website for your lab now?
It's being updated right now. It's currently a Google Sites thing, but I'll be, you know, it's becoming like a, I guess, an adult lab website now. So I will send it your way when it's ready.
Gotcha. We'll do. And Rachel, is there anything you want to share link-wise or anything?
I don't have anything personally, no.
Okay. I think I have the link to the to your paper. I have the preprint, but I'll put the link up, and you know, the abstract is on there, so I'm sure some of the listeners will have an interest in that. So I'll post that if you don't mind.
Yeah, in the preprint, it now shows the link to the published paper. It's open in Sioux Biology, so whoever wants to read the final version, they can find it up there.
Gotcha. That's great. All right, everyone. Again, I want to thank Roberto and Rachel for taking the time to talk to us about this. Phyllobates is an amazing genus. It's been one of my favorite genera for the longest time. And this type of work is just so interesting. And, my mind is blown. the green leg and the Uraba locales, that in and alone just blew my mind. So, again, two great people. I want to thank them so much for coming on, talking to us. And, I hope you guys enjoyed it. Got more coming up. Catch up with you again next time.